They catch your podcast conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking on a really monumental period of history. Mm-hmm. We're aiming our intellectual spotlight right at one of Western civilization's most stubborn narratives.
The big one, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire.
Exactly.
That narrative is just so baked into our collective memory, isn't it? For centuries, and you know, thanks mostly to Edward Gibbon's famous work from the 18th century,
right.
The whole period after 250 AD has been painted as this long, sad epilogue.
Just everything great about Rome slowly decayed.
Yeah, under pressure from, you know, Christianity right. And the so-called barbarians.
And so our mission today, with Gillian Clark's incredible work, her very short introduction to late antiquity,
is to just throw that idea of decline out the window.
We're not looking at a fall. We're looking at a creative, necessary, and really complex transformation. We're zeroing in on this crucial 500-year window from about 250 to 750 AD. And this isn't just, you know, some academic game of relabeling history.
No.
Understanding this era, this crucible, is so important because this is where the foundations for the three major medieval civilizations were actually laid.
Western Europe, the Byzantine Empire in the East.
And eventually the Islamic Caliphate. It teaches us a huge lesson about resilience.
You mean how do societies actually handle massive, systemic, just unavoidable transformation?
Exactly. Because late antiquity was basically the historical equivalent of a total societal rebuild.
And our guide through all this is Professor Emerita Gillian Clark.
She is just a powerhouse in classics and ancient history.
Yeah.
She's especially known for her work on late antiquity and the church fathers, particularly Augustine.
So what makes her the perfect guide for us, for the curious learner?
Well, for one, Clark moves way beyond those, you know, grand, dusty narratives of just emperors and battles.
Mm-hmm.
Her focus is on the lived experience. She uses primary sources that feel so immediate, like personal letters, sermons, even daily legal codes.
So you get a feel for what it was actually like to be alive then.
Exactly. When your whole world order is collapsing and reforming at the same time.
What I find so compelling is her intellectual range.
Oh, it's incredible. Her expertise spans both classical pagan philosophy and early Christian theology.
And that dual literacy is just invaluable, right? It guarantees you're getting a non-biased view of this synthesis.
Yeah, she sees so clearly that the old world didn't just vanish. It was blended. It was adapted by the new. It wasn't simple replacement. It was this complex, rigorous blending.
She combines that historical rigor with perfect accessibility. You come away realizing this era wasn't about gloom and decay.
Not at all. It was about grappling with massive change and adapting, often, you know, quite brilliantly.
Okay, so let's get right into her central thesis. She demands that we see the period from 250 to 750 AD not as some sad, decaying epilogue of Rome,
but as a dynamic, distinct historical era, one defined by creative adaptation and reinvention.
She's actively replacing that old Gibbonian idea that Christianity and barbarism destroyed classical excellence.
Right. She's replacing it with a far more nuanced understanding. It was a centuries-long, often messy, sometimes violent, but fundamentally necessary process of remaking everything.
Society, religion, politics, even personal identity from the ground up.
It really is a fantastic journey she takes us on. The book tracks these key pivots, these turning points.
Like the political religious shift started by Constantine.
Mm-hmm. And then the massive evolution of Roman law under people like Justinian, the rise of powerful new social forces like monasticism.
And then finally that huge geographical and political divergence that split the Mediterranean world in three.
And Clark really emphasizes that this journey is continuous. It culminates, but it doesn't end with the rise of Islam.
So she sees the caliphate not as some external shock to the system.
Not at all. She sees it as another product, another civilization born directly out of this late antique, religiously charged post-imperial environment.
That idea of continuity brings us to the first big concept she discusses, which is inventing late antiquity.
Yeah, the term itself is actually a modern scholarly concept. It was championed by historians like Peter Brown back in the 1970s.
And it was developed on purpose to be more analytical and positive than, say, the Dark Ages.
And that's such a crucial insight. Labels matter.
Hmm.
By calling it late antiquity, Clark encourages historians to stop looking for things that broke and start looking for innovation, adaptation, and continuity.
So the name itself is like a research directive. It shifts the whole inquiry from tragedy to birth.
Exactly. And the greatest engine driving this change, the one that was irreversible, was religious.
Which she explores in the chapter 1, Empire Under God.
Mm-hmm. That's where Constantine steps onto the stage around 306 to 337 and just changes everything.
By converting to and actively patronizing Christianity.
The consequences were immediate and profound. I mean, yes, the church gained resources and power.
But the emperor became tangled up in theology.
Inextricably. Clark shows how theological disputes like the Arian controversy were no longer just, you know, private debates among priests.
Okay, wait. Just remind us what the Arian controversy was. Why was it so important politically?
So Arianism was fundamentally questioning the nature of Christ. It argued that Jesus was subordinate to God the Father, not co-eternal or co-equal.
Ah, okay.
So if the emperor backed the wrong theological side, he could lose his divine mandate and, in the eyes of his subjects, his own soul.
Wow, so it transformed theology into a matter of state security.
Lethal state security. Religious orthodoxy became directly linked to public order and imperial stability.
So as the religious landscape gets more complicated, the Roman system tries to impose order, and we see that in the law.
Yeah, in the chapter Law and Order, you immediately see this shift in the emperor's job description. He goes from being the princeps, the first citizen.
Right, from the old republican tradition.
To the dominus, the absolute divinely sanctioned ruler. The state became larger, more bureaucratic, more centralized.
But what's amazing is the Roman resilience you see through their legal institutions. They didn't just let the rules collapse.
No, they systematically created these monumental legal codes. You had the Theodosian Code, and then Justinian's crowning achievement, the Corpus Juris Civilis, in the 6th century.
And the scale of that vision is just mind-boggling.
It really is. This wasn't just recycling old laws. It was the systematization of centuries of Roman thought.
Which then became the legal DNA for almost every European civil law country for the next 1,000 years.
That is not decline. That is monumental legal preservation and transmission. They were actively trying to impose order and enshrine Christian morality into the very framework of the state.
So moving away from the capital at the same time as these huge political and legal shifts, you have a revolution in social and spiritual life.
Yeah, this is covered in souls and bodies and sacred landscapes. And the profound change here is the rise of asceticism.
Extreme self-denial and spiritual discipline.
This is where we meet the desert fathers and mothers. Figures like Saint Anthony, who deliberately operated outside the traditional structures of the urban imperial church.
Right. They dedicated themselves to this rigorous spiritual discipline, often in really extreme conditions.
Some stood on pillars for decades. Others refused basic human comforts.
And what's so critical is that these figures became powerful new social authorities.
Mm-hmm. Their visible spiritual charisma gave them immense moral legitimacy.
So people would actually bypass the local bishop or even the imperial courts to go ask a holy man in the desert for advice.
All the time. For legal advice, for intervention, they provided this whole new source of authority right when the traditional authority was, you know, crumbling.
And at the same time, the cult of saints and relics become central to popular devotion.
Which fundamentally reshapes what people valued. And this spiritual revolution was also profoundly physical.
You mean the actual remaking of the landscape?
Yes. New basilicas, often funded by the emperor, replaced pagan temples. Pilgrimage created entirely new, shared sacred geographies across the empire. It was a tangible, visible revolution.
And we also have to challenge that idea of the intellectual dark ages.
Absolutely. Clark tackles this in education and literature. Classical education, the Paideia, it definitely persisted.
But it was adapted for Christians.
Completely. You have scholars like Augustine and Jerome using their mastery of classical rhetoric and philosophy, not for epic poetry, but for writing theology and establishing Christian doctrine.
And that intellectual continuation brings us to a huge but often overlooked technological aha moment.
The shift from the papyrus scroll to the codex.
Okay, so why does changing from a roll to a book fundamentally change civilization? That seems kind of minor.
Oh, it's absolutely critical. Think about it. Scrolls were linear. You had to read them from start to finish.
You couldn't just flip to a specific section.
Exactly. The codex, the ancestor of the modern book, is durable, it's portable, and allows for random access for indexing, cross-referencing. It revolutionized how you could manage and master these huge, complex bodies of work. like the Bible, or, really importantly, Justinian's massive new law codes. It ensured the survival of complex knowledge.
So this intellectual preservation leads directly to the great geopolitical split, which she covers in East is East and West is West.
Yeah, the paths of the two halves of the empire just diverge dramatically.
In the West, central political authority basically fragments.
Right, leading to these successor kingdoms set up by Germanic groups, the Goths, Vandals, Franks.
But Clark stresses this was a process of accommodation and cultural fusion. It wasn't simple invasion and destruction.
No, not at all. When a Visigoth leader in Spain needed to govern his Roman subjects, he didn't invent a new tax system.
He kept the Roman tax collectors on the payroll.
And often married into the local elite. The goal was frequently to maintain Roman systems and, you know, the revenue that came with them.
Meanwhile, the East consolidates.
Centered on Constantinople, which was never conquered, it becomes the stable, urbanized, Greek-speaking Byzantine Empire.
And figures like Emperor Justinian solidify this distinctly Eastern medieval civilization with those huge legal projects and architectural marvels like the Hagia Sophia.
And that stability allowed the East to survive for another 1,000 years.
And then finally, the epilogue. The rise of Islam in the 7th century isn't presented as some sudden external event.
No, it's situated as the ultimate logical outcome of this whole high-stakes, religiously charged late antique environment. It finalizes that three-way split of the Mediterranean world.
Byzantium, the Islamic Caliphate, and the fragmented kingdoms of the West.
That's it.
That's an incredible overview. So let's talk about the key themes that really stick with you after reading this, the big lessons.
Okay, theme one has to be transformation over decline.
That's the core message.
It is. It's such a powerful reframing tool. Clark consistently shows that the fall in the West was really just political fragmentation that led to this necessary and often creative cultural fusion.
And the takeaway for us today is to be skeptical of modern decline narratives.
Exactly. Look for the creative beginnings and new structures that are being hidden by the apparent collapse of the old.
I love that. Okay, theme two, the overwhelming impact of religious change.
Yeah, Christianity wasn't a minor tweak. It was the primary overwhelming engine of transformation.
It affected politics, law, identity, the physical world, everything.
Religion became the absolute central organizing principle of society. And understanding that faith or ideology wasn't a private affair, but the main axis of power, helps us analyze the role of powerful ideologies today.
Whether they're political, economic, or religious.
Exactly. How they shape our modern global landscape.
And finally, theme three, new forms of authority.
Right. When central imperial power fractures, new power structures rush in to fill that vacuum.
So Christian bishops become these local civic leaders handling justice and charity.
And the spiritual charisma of the holy man gains this immense social influence. It's a crucial lesson in how power localizes and legitimizes itself when central secular authority fails.
Let's pull out some of the core ideas from the book, the ones that are really memorable.
Okay.
The first is simple, but it just reframes your whole perspective. Late antiquity was not the final chapter of the ancient world, but the first chapter of a new one.
That just shifts the historical focus entirely, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It tells us to stop seeing history as a tragedy and start seeing it as a difficult, messy, but necessary birth.
It moves the focus from failure to potential.
Exactly.
Okay, the second one revolves around that critical event in the 4th century. The conversion of Constantine was not just the triumph of Christianity, but the transformation of Christianity itself.
That highlights the two-way synthesis.
Yeah.
Yes, the empire changed for Christianity.
But Christianity changed dramatically. It got new political theories. It got tangled up with state machinery.
And developed new artistic and architectural standards to accommodate the state. It was a mutual transformation.
And the third idea directly challenges our old textbook bias. The so-called barbarians were not destroyers of civilization, but participants in its transformation.
This is so crucial for getting past that simplistic clash narrative. These groups weren't uniformly hostile. They admired and adapted Roman institutions.
So the new Western kingdoms were a product of fusion and accommodation, not just destruction.
Precisely.
So how do we apply all of this historical analysis to our daily lives, to our understanding of the modern world? Clark's framework offers some really powerful, practical insights.
It really does. Application one for me is institutional adaptation and resilience.
Okay.
The stark contrast between the West's fragmentation and the East's successful adaptation into Byzantium. that offers real lessons on institutional flexibility.
So maintaining core values like the rule of law, while also being willing to embrace necessary, sometimes radical change is the key to survival.
That's it. That's the key to institutional survival in a changing world.
That's great. What about application two?
Intercultural dialogue and fusion. The way she portrays Roman and Gothic accommodations serves as this historical mirror for modern debates on integration and multiculturalism.
Right. It shows that cultures change each other. They aren't static things that just assimilate or eradicate one another.
They participate in mutual transformation, and that leads to these unexpected hybrid results.
Okay, and the last one. Skepticism of modern decline narratives.
Yes. Clark's work teaches us to look past the anxiety-inducing headlines about the decline of modern institutions, whether it's democracy or global markets.
Instead, we should analytically examine the systems emerging in the void.
Stop grieving the old structure and start mapping the new one. Is power moving to megacorporations, to social media platforms, to non-state actors?
So those are the new bishops and holy men rising to power in our own fragmented environment.
You got it.
What surprised me most in this deep dive, and what I really loved, was the sheer scope of intellectual creativity that survived.
Mm.
The synthesis between classical learning and new Christian thought, the work of people like Augustine, Boethius, Cassiodorus, it was actively designed to preserve and transmit knowledge through the codex.
That intellectual DNA was consciously saved.
Yes. And it became the basis for the entire medieval future.
For me, my lasting takeaway is the power of the redefinition of identity.
Oh, so.
As political unity failed in the West, identity fundamentally shifted. Being a subject of Rome became secondary. Identity became defined by religion, Orthodox Christian in the East, Catholic Christian in the West.
So a shared belief system becomes the ultimate unifying force across different political entities.
It proves that belief can be more stabilizing than bureaucracy.
And that leaves us with this provocative thought for you to consider. Think about the biggest societal shifts happening in the world right now, whether they're technological, climate, or political. Which elements of our current society will be destroyed, and which will be creatively adapted and preserved for the world of 250 years from now? See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world.
This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.